Okay, well, I think there's a few people who'll be coming, but we'll get started now. Welcome to the CSIS Careers in Global Development Series. And with me today is Clarence Edwards. And he's had a very interesting and varied career in a variety of kinds of international relations activities that sometimes you don't think of first. I'll get the end to the race car driving thing later. But Clarence works right now as the senior advisor at the Australian Embassy, and he focuses on international development and particularly the relationship with the United States, NGOs, and the private sector. And he's been very involved in advocacy for a number of years. Prior to this, he was with the Albert Sabin Vaccine Institute. Yeah. Working for increased funding for ignored tropical diseases, and before that with Bono and the One campaign and the Gates Foundation, looking for more funding for HIV, AIDS, malaria, and TB. Prior to getting into his career of advocacy, he was very much focused on communications strategies and management, and was advising various governments and business leaders on how to develop their strategy and that sort of thing. And he also ran the congressional program at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was a political appointee during the Clinton years in the State Department and handled foreign reporters and foreign news agencies. And before that, he did a stint as a photojournalism covering the Grand Prix races in Europe.
Yeah, I went to Europe for a few months and covered the French Grand Prix back in 87 and Spa-Francorchamps and a couple of others.
That actually interests me more. Anyway, we won't get into that. And he's a graduate of the University of Maryland and SAIS here in Washington, D.C. So what I would like to do is I'm going to begin and ask him two or three questions, and then we'll open it up to everyone here. It was on the agenda that this will go from 3:30 to 5. We're actually going to do the question and answer session from 3:30 to 4:30, because quite often there's people who want to ask a question not in front of a large group, so there will be a little time that he'll be around yet to talk to folks that way as well. So I guess my first question is, you've had a very varied career in international development. And could you talk a little bit about how your career evolved and how you got into this and moved to different areas of international development and that sort of thing?
Sure, sure. First of all, thank you, Ambassador and CSIS, for this opportunity to talk about myself. I got into international development, it's almost serendipity. It was right place at the right time. I had a background working on Capitol Hill and doing advocacy and running the congressional program, as you said, at the Council on Foreign Relations. And after I decided to leave CFR, I did some consulting briefly and started working on development-related issues. One thing that I did for 6 months was as a short-term consultant at the World Bank, helping with messaging around their work in the Congo Basin forestry. And that led one day to me having a conversation with a friend of mine about working on development advocacy. And I actually just applied for a job in the back of Roll Call back when they advertised jobs in the back of magazines and newspapers. But I answered an ad, and it turned out to be for this lobbying firm called the Sheridan Group, and one of their clients was Bono and the One campaign. So it was just dumb luck, basically, that led to it. And so it's evolved from there.
Well, I just have to add, it's very interesting. In the people I've talked to in these various sessions, you'd be surprised how many people had no intention of getting into the international field and making a career of it. Personally, I was going to be a history professor. That didn't work out, thank goodness. And I spent 40 years in the State Department and AID.
You know, it's funny, though, because I came down to Washington in the early 90s, and my goal was to work at the intersection of politics and international affairs. So as an intern once in Senator Sarbanes' office, I wrote a letter to the senator back when people wrote letters on paper. It was 1989, actually. And I wrote a letter to the senator, and I said I wanted to work in politics and international affairs. And I got the internship. And so I'd always had the desire to be in Washington and to work on international affairs issues, but I never defined it more than that. I just sort of targeted this city and those issues, and so it's evolved from there.
What, just to follow on the diversity of your career, as you look at the various positions you've held on Capitol Hill, the State Department, the private sector, think tanks, foundations, you've sort of run the gamut.
Yeah.
What are some of the pros and cons of those various organizations that you work for, you know, and some, and maybe some of the pitfalls?
One of the pros is that if you're working for a large organization like a multilateral, even in that short period with the bank, or my current job with the Australian Embassy in government, or working in the U.S. government with the State Department, and I also did a year at the Department of Energy back in 2010-2011 to get better insight into how energy impacts development issues. Large organizations are really good for if you're starting out your career or at any point in your career because they have such a range of opportunities and areas to get into. So I think that that's one of the pros. A large organization, I go back and forth. Sometimes I like large organizations, sometimes I like smaller ones. But I think large organizations give you the opportunity to get into a lot of different areas.
Yeah.
You know, at the State Department, I started out as a political working at the Washington Foreign Press Center and working with foreign media and then doing foreign visits when President Clinton went down to Santiago for the Summit of the Americas. So it offered all these different options to get into different areas. The downside is bureaucracy. Any large organization, and it doesn't matter whether it's the public sector or the private sector, bureaucracy is bureaucracy, and it's just it's not bad, but it's just slow, and things take time, and there are processes. So it's a trade-off, and you have to pick and choose depending on your personality and what you work best in. I feel like I work best in I'm flexible. I can work in all different types of organizations.
Interesting. Yeah, good point. Well, let's open it up to a few questions now. Please, if you have a question, state your name and your affiliation so Clarence knows who he's talking to. And then I'll get back to a few more of my questions in a little bit. So, anyone? You're going to be shy back there?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Adriana Weiss. You just mentioned briefly that you worked for the Department of Energy because you felt that that would sort of enhance your understanding of how energy impacts international relations. Could you talk more about how you felt that need arose, and then were there any difficulties with sort of shifting gears maybe going into energy versus other things that you'd focused on?
Yeah, after working for Albert Sabin Vaccine Institute, I set up their public policy program. I decided to go over to DOE with, like, as I said, the idea of learning more about how energy actually works, for lack of a better term, and how it impacts the international community and the environment and dynamics. To be frank with you, it wasn't the smartest career choice I've made because I went from an organization that was probably 25 people to the Department of Energy, which I don't know how many thousands they have. And great organization, great people, but it's a perfect example of, and it'll happen in your career. Sometimes you don't make the smartest choice. It looks like a good choice at the time. And it just, the dynamic of it was different. I was a policy advocate. I mean, I've been up on the Hill advocating for PEPFAR and the Global Fund. And at DOE, you know, I turned into a budget analyst. And no one's going to hire me to analyze a budget. It's just not what I do. So I learned a lot there, but it was just a different environment. And so, but I did learn what I went there to learn. But it's a good example of it's important to maybe look a little bit deeper before you leap, because like I said, it wasn't quite the fit that I thought it would be. But I still learned positively from it.
In the back there.
My name is Prosper. I'd like to know how your understanding of development evolved, because a lot of people who go into development, they're world savers, and you get there, you realize that, like what you're saying, that things sometimes are slow, or they're all kind of the politics and the bureaucracy. How have you been able to reconcile your passion for development with all that conundrum that usually could put people off? Or kind of a discourage, especially young people who want to go into development.
You mean the day-to-day sort of
versus the day-to-day, and there's all kinds of criticism about development and whether it works and, you know, how much it works. And, yeah, there's all kinds of things in the media. And when you get on the ground, you can be discouraged by the immensity of the problems and the effectiveness of what you're doing and all of that.
Well, here's what I'll say, a couple of things. My development career is one of those where I hesitate to even call it a career in international development. It's funny to say that now that I'm sitting up here. But I've been very focused on policy. And so my friends in the development arena who work on the ground are like, well, you'll be a real development professional when you're in the DRC somewhere, or, you know, out in Papua New Guinea or something. And so my angle on it and my perspective on it is entirely shaped by the policy committee, being up on the Hill and negotiating for that money, for, you know, helping to shape or understand development policy between the U.S. and Australia and other countries. So it's a different perspective on it. I'm sorry, could you sort of like tell me the second part of your question there?
I wanted to know how you've reconciled those, that bureaucracy, the slowness, and your passion for making things move fast and work and deliver on all the promises of development, especially on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something over time that you learn how to balance the, like I was saying, about the bureaucracy or the challenges of the nitty-gritty of getting money for development projects or understanding development policy and so forth, versus a very different world of implementing aid projects in a country. So they're two, I mean, for me, they're two entirely different skill sets and mindsets. I do notice that when people in the aid community who've worked in the field have to spend any time in a place like Washington or Geneva or Canberra, that sort of culture shock definitely emanates from them. And I would imagine that if I have to spend any time out in the field in country X or Y, I would go through the same thing. But I think that over the course of your career, it's just like anything. It's a balance, and you have to learn how to surf the difficulties of bureaucracy versus difficulties of dealing with the field. And you know, wish I could give you a better answer than that, but I think it's a real feel thing, and it's important to understand what drives you and what drives your interest and passion, and then marry that with the environment that you're in order for it to be effective, if that makes sense.
Hello, my name is Mohammed. I'm a graduate student at Georgetown University, focusing on international development. So reflecting back on your background and experience, what kind of skills you wish you've had before entering this field in general?
More language skills. I think that's even more important these days. But one skill that I wish I'd nailed down or been more serious about, because I speak basic French and sort of intermediate Spanish or so, depending on the day. But I think that communication skills, just in any language or so, but in additional language skills are the bedrock of a career, not just in international development, but I think in any career these days, particularly in this era. So your ability to, as a young person or as someone coming out of graduate school, or even at my age or so, I think it's really important to understand how to communicate clearly and effectively in your office environment with your colleagues. And I don't just mean talking, but I think it's really important to understand how to listen. And that is probably, for my money, the most important skill. Secondly, language skills and area knowledge is also important, but language skills, I think those two things will get you very far. And I don't know whether you can teach emotional empathy, but if you can, you should learn it if you don't have it, because I think there's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence and jobs that will not be existing in 5, 10, 15 years or so. And a lot of people say that the skill sets that will be most important are the ones that are human and are empathetic. And, the development arena is a very human area. It's about people directly. And so I think that if you're going into this area, having those people skills and communication skills are more important in some degree. Degree is important, but having those skills is very important to come out with.
Over here.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Jerome Heradura, and I work for the Asian Development Bank. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're into international development, but there was a time that you worked as budget analyst. Somehow I could relate to that, and I would like to seek your advice. When I was in the headquarters in Manila, and I was there for 10 years working on development partnerships, basically with multilaterals and bilaterals. And then my new assignment in ADB happened in November 2017, so a little more than a year now. Mm-hmm. I'm working on the finance, administration and budget of our small office here in DC. It's a good opportunity as well, because I wanted to rest from development. I've been working on that for 10 years. But coming here, I saw a lot more opportunities to do more partnerships, like maybe the private sector foundations and some philanthropic organizations, right? I would like to seek your advice, because now that I'm exposed to this more potential partners, I'd like to do more on development. But at the same time, I have this work on budget and finance and administration, which is also time consuming. So what would be your advice to me, considering that I'm working on this aspect, and at the same time, I'd like to continue on the development side without leaving ADB. And at the same time, it's an indefinite assignment, but mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to headquarters maybe after 5 years and continue the development work. So what would be your advice, this, without leaving ADB at the same time, getting these opportunities to work with foundations and other potential partners? Thank you.
I was smiling because when you said you wanted to take a break from development for a while, and after lobbying and advocacy for Gates, I worked for a firm called Sheridan Group, a lobbying firm, and so we represented Gates Foundation and One Campaign and the Enough Project. But after a few years of that and a couple of other assignments, one of the other reasons I went to DOE was because I was really tired of the international development arena. Advocating for more money, it kind of burns you out after a while. So, I was like, I want a break from development. And I got over to DOE as a budget analyst, and I thought, I want to go back to development. But the skill set that you have, it's not to, what I say about my experience isn't to denigrate being a budget analyst or anything. It just wasn't me. It's a great skill for you to have. and combine it with other work that you're doing here. And one of the cool things about Washington, D.C. is that it is a big campus. This is like this town is almost like a gigantic university. There's so many opportunities to educate yourself outside of your job. There are think tanks like this, there's events. So if I were you, I would, nail down what you know how to do really well. And this is something I was thinking about the other day when I was thinking about coming over here. I think it's really important to nail down a key skill, whatever that skill is. If it's, for me, it was knowledge of Capitol Hill and the Congress. And that's how I ended up becoming a lobbyist and advocate, because I know how Congress works, or I know how Congress used to work. but I understand how Congress, I understand how the administration works. That's why I got hired over at the Australian Embassy. I understand how government works. It's always good to have one key skill like that where you're an expert in it. For you, it might be budget. And then you can pivot off of that skill and go into other areas using the credibility that you've built up. And in terms of budget, everyone's always going to need someone who's good with the numbers and budget. So take that skill, reach out for another skill, pivot off of your original skill, and then get into something else. And you don't need permission to learn something new and to go into a new area. So in a nutshell, that's how I do it. And I would imagine you've got a great organization over there, and Australia appreciates its relationship with the ADB, both here and over in the Indo-Pacific. You've got great resources and opportunities within the organization there.
Up here in the second row, third row.
Thanks. My name's Claire Zhou, so I come from China. I have over 7 years working experience for international embassies in China, and I came here for graduate study. So my question to you is, right now I'm facing a career transition because I'm trying to transfer from government section into development, international development. So I would like to ask, in all your professional life, did you ever have a period of time that you have a career transition? And it's like you from government section to private, or either way. And what do you have a moment you feel very difficult, and what are those difficulties, and how did you resolve those difficulties? I'd like to know your experience. Thank you.
Do you mean make difficulties in making career transitions between different?
Yes, mainly like a sector transactions, but also can be like, I understand you have been working on the Hill. You were working on the Hill, and then later you begin to work for like Bill Gates, Melinda Gates Foundation. And also then now you're working for the Australian Embassy. Although it's mainly about international development, but there are sections differences. And when you trying to get into a different sector, what kind of difficulty you find there are, and how did you resolve those difficulties? That is my question. Thank you.
Well, it kind of relates to what we were talking about just in the previous question, because I used my background, and it's not like I sat and thought about this 20 plus years ago and said I'm going to do it like this. It was just more sort of made it up as I went along. But in retrospect, what I did was I took my knowledge and understanding of the Congress, and that helped me to get into, that and working on the Clinton-Gore campaign helped me to get into the administration, where I did some congressional work within the Clinton administration, but I also was able to pivot a little bit into working with the media. And so I've always had opportunities, and I've had really good mentors in my career too, which is another thing that's super important to have, It's been key to my career. But I've always taken the job that I've been doing, whether it was for the Sheridan Group, working with One Campaign and Gates Foundation, or Sabin, there's always a piece of it that led to the next position. Council on Foreign Relations, it was Congress, my understanding of Congress. So there's always an element of a job that can help lead to the next job if you're thinking about it strategically. So it's And it's not something you can plan out, but it's more of an organic, and it's a feel. It's like, what am I interested in? How do I see my career evolving in this particular position? Are there other opportunities in this area that I'm interested in? And just sort of swimming upstream towards those.
Up here in the front.
Thank you. My name is Hirut. I'm from Catholic University of America, graduate student in international development, focusing on development policy. My question is, when you look back to 20 years back, do you find it beneficial working in different sectors, or do you advise, especially young professionals who are interested in international development, focus in one sector and work on it?
My advice would be, you ask whether to focus on one sector or?
Yeah, you have experience in different sectors. So when you think back, do you find it beneficial working in different sectors, or do you advise, especially now, young professionals who are interested in international development, focus on one area, or is there synergy or project management or something? Or is that, do you find it beneficial working in different sectors?
Yeah, for me, that's a hard one, because for me, being a generalist, I mean, I don't know, I've advocated and done strategic communications around global health issues and education and agriculture, but my knowledge of those sectors is an inch deep. So, you know, my specialty was how to communicate about them and how to advocate. So from my perspective, being a generalist and not getting deep into one area it's worked for me. But if you are compelled to pursue a focus on, say, agriculture or project management, I think that you should do that. The hesitancy comes in, this is such a turbulent age and issues, and things are changing so fast that I hesitate to say to anyone, oh, you should go deep in one particular sector, because, I mean, who knows, you know? I mean, and it's always been like that. It's not just this era that's like that. It's always been like that. It's hard to say you should do X or you should go right into project management. Probably that's fine, or probably a focus on agriculture or education would be fine. But for me, I was more interested in sort of like the much bigger picture and the broader playing field of it. And so I'll say that, number one. And number two, even if you decide to go in a particular sector, here's an important thing to know at the beginning of your career. You can always change your mind. You can always go in a different direction. You know, it's easier to do that earlier than sort of maybe middle or later in your career. But as a young person coming out of grad school and getting into the development sector, learn as many sort of hardcore basics as you can, I'd say, but don't get so hung up on, I've got to go deep in a particular sector. And don't listen to any pressure from people who tell you you have to do that, because my opinion is you don't necessarily need to I see it as overcommitting. So maintain your flexibility. And you can get into different sectors and move around. But I feel like it's important to, for me at least, it's been important to have a broader sort of perspective and not, I'm a good generalist. That's my sector, being a generalist.
I would agree with that 100%. Yeah, absolutely. Over here.
Hello. I'm Danielle Emmett. I'm a recent graduate from last year with a bachelor's in history. I'm currently looking for a career in international development. And I have a bit more of a philosophical question, perhaps, but I think it's important given the nature of the international development field. And that is, if you ever find yourself, perhaps you have, perhaps not, but if you ever find yourself in a position, especially in a larger company or a multilateral development firm, where you don't have enough individual clout, where you have to work on a project or the company is going in a direction that you may not necessarily feel is the correct path or may even be detrimental. How do you reconcile your own individual, you know, moral compass with whatever project you happen to be working on?
Wow. That's tough. I mean, you know, because whether you work for the government or whether you work for a nonprofit or a foundation, or you're probably the only way that you're going to avoid that issue is if you're your own solo entrepreneur. So, I mean, there's always going to be, in large or any type of organization, you're just going to face that situation where there's something that that organization might be espousing or doing that you don't necessarily believe in. You just have to decide for yourself what's your percentage of tolerance for that, you know? That's a personal decision you have to make, and you'll face it in your career. I mean, look, you can't avoid it. And so your organization may do something and you may read in the paper, you think, that's ridiculous or terrible or, you know, on that level. But you have to decide yourself internally, within yourself, whether it's something that you feel is a breaking point or is a red line for you. And then if it is, you have to decide whether you want to stay with that or not. But on every different level, whether it's macro or even micro level, maybe you have a boss that you don't like or makes wrong decisions in your mind or so, but you have to own your own, you have to walk into situations with your eyes fully open and understand that, you know, situations like this will come up, and then make your own personal decision as to whether it's something that you can live with. So, not to give you a super philosophical answer back to a philosophical question, but yeah, does that answer? Okay, sure.
All right, start in the back, and we'll work forward.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Eric. I'm a graduate student at Georgetown studying global health. Before coming to Georgetown, I was working in health program evaluations, specifically for maternal mental health programs in indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. And after a few years doing that, I realized that these programs weren't very effective because the policy framework that was necessary for them to be effective was not in place. And so I'm hoping to use my graduate education to hopefully pivot to policy analysis and creation. And so, just considering your, you know, previous, you know, chapters of your career in policy, what would your advice be to someone who's trying to make that pivot specifically into policy when maybe they don't have such a robust history in policy up until this point?
You're doing what now?
I study global health at Georgetown, but my concentration is on governance and policy analysis.
Okay. It sounds like you've got the range of skills. You want to get deeper into policy?
Right. Well, I come from a research and evaluation background, but I want to go into policy. But besides, you know, my classes that I've taken at Georgetown, I don't really have like a strong foundation in it, but I'm interested in it. And so I'm wondering if, you know, because you've transitioned sectors so much in your career.
Sure, but you do have if you have an underpinning in research and evaluation, then you have an underpinning in sort of the building blocks of policy work or policy making. So you have to look at your whatever skill. Like you have to sort of imagine your skill set at any part of your career as like a car engine, and you take that engine out. This analogy is not going to work out. You're moving back out of it. Imagine your career as a refrigerator, and it's full of food, and you're cleaning out your refrigerator. You take everything out. You have to sort of look at your career and look at the components of it, and as objectively as possible, analyze it and think, okay, where can this, I know a lot about research or monitoring and evaluation, and do some study and figure out, okay, where can this path, where can this lead me? What is it that I do that overlaps with what people in the policy, in a particular policy arena need? Because I guarantee you, if you really step back and look at your skills, and don't just do it yourself, you know, career services or friends or mentors, once again, it's really important to have. Just have some, take a look at your skills, have someone else look at your skills, and just really walk through it and think, how does this thing that I know how to do, and I, this is more thought than I put into it. I just sort of jumped into stuff and it worked out. But like, really take a look at your skill set and then look at where you're trying to go. Look at job descriptions, talk to people, figure out those avenues, because the information is all out there. And I guarantee you can get from what you do now to getting into policy. And it's, I think it's going to be more straightforward than you think. But what I'm recommending to you is a real deep analysis of your skills and what you're working on now, and then looking at where you want to go, analyze that, think about it, talk to people, take a couple of shots at applying for things and see what kind of feedback you get, and just keep iterating that whole process. And you can, if it's what you want to do, you can make it happen and you can get there. But just put the work into really looking at your skill set and thinking about it and analyzing it. And if you do that with some outside assistance and some outside support, you'll be able to figure out that pathway. Because particularly with what you're talking about, there's room in the policy arena for the skills that you bring to the table.
All right, there. The white shirt, and then we'll get to you next.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm a current graduate student at George Washington studying public health, and I'm also an intern at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Earlier you mentioned mentors and the significance of mentors. I believe we've all had a mentor in our lives, and we're also many graduate students in here. Can you maybe reflect on one or two mentors, and particularly how they became your mentor, and also who were they, and most importantly, the lesson that, or one of the key takeaways you had, you took from this mentor. Thank you.
Yeah, Gavi's a great organization. My first mentor was actually a whole lobbying firm that was called Griffin Johnson. I think it's Bolin Griffin, something or other now, or Bolin Madigan. But back in the early 90s, it was Griffin Johnson and Associates. And it was about seven corporate lobbyists. And I started out as the research assistant. And David Johnson and Pat Griffin. And I didn't have my undergraduate degree at the time. I came down from Baltimore. I'd done a year at Johns Hopkins. And I decided I wanted to work during the day and go to school at night and work in Washington. And so I was working for Griffin Johnson. And they, bless you, they, we were sitting at, we were all sitting out at dinner one night at the firm, down the street from the firm, and the partner of the firm, David Johnson, turned to me and said, I'll pay for you to finish your undergrad, however much it costs, send me the bill for it. And so we set that up, and he did that. And then Pat Griffin helped me to get on the Clinton-Gore campaign. And then Jack Dover and Bill Kitzmiller basically taught me how to analyze legislation and lobby the Hill. So I got tremendously lucky to have some great mentors who actually also happened to be some of those plugged-in lobbyists in Washington, D.C. So they, honestly, it's right place at right time there, but I'd like to think that they saw something in me. So they are the underpinning of my career, and that's why I say mentors are important, because they, you know, and I didn't have a glamorous job at all. It was you know, writing reports and then having one of the lobbyists put their names on it and sending it to the clients. But I learned a tremendous amount, and they gave me the opportunity to learn a lot. And they helped, frankly, they helped open doors for me. So I will always remember them being extremely important. And I try to pay that forward when I can. So I learned a lot from them, and I've learned a lot from every employer I've had and every boss that I've had. There's always people who are mentor-like. My former boss over at the embassy, Chris Tenning, the guy that hired me, turned out to be a tremendous influence and mentor for me, and just in terms of the way he worked, the way he works, and his attitude towards work, and helping me to believe in myself. So, yeah, mentors, and it's not easy. It's not like you can just go out, you can't just go out and find a mentor, I know, but there are people out there who are willing to give their time and to listen to you and where you're coming from. So, Griffin Johnson & Associates, the whole firm of mentors. I got very lucky.
We're here.
Hi, my name is Alicia Alt. I currently work at Steptoe, an international law firm just down the street. And my question is for those considering graduate programs in international affairs, or perhaps more specifically in development. The reaction I've received from some people when I speak about graduate programs in Europe is, oh, well, will you be able to find a job in the U.S.? And I wonder what your opinion is of reputable schools in Europe, Sciences Po, LSE, or perhaps more specifically Sussex, which has a great development program, and whether you think that makes a difference in a career, first in international development, and then more specifically, perhaps in the U.S. government, so USAID or the State Department. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. My opinion is that the people who, for the fields that we're talking about, the people who will look at your credentials know about those schools. So Sciences Po isn't a mystery to people in the foreign policy or development field, even in the U.S. Obviously not LSE. I applied to two schools when I went to graduate school after the end of the Clinton administration. I only applied to two. I applied to SAIS and I applied to LSE. And I would have gone, I got into SAIS, but I would have gone to LSE. I think what you're pointing out in terms of like people saying, well, people won't know that degree, I think that was more of an issue in the past. But I think that things are so interconnected now, and people have heard of all of these schools. So I don't see it as being, I don't think it would be detrimental to your career. I also think you should just go to SAIS.
If I could just add, during my career, I hired a lot of people for AID, and all those schools are well known. And if you look at AID, there's graduates from all of them in AID, in the State Department. As you said, it's a real mixture now. Everybody knows whether it's Stellenbosch University down in South Africa, or a number of the other ones in Europe, or the, you know, that they're all well known now.
And I'll add to what we've both said, that it's not just the school, how you whether you get hired when you come out and all that is really important, but one of the most important and one of the best things about going to SAIS or going to grad school for me were the people that I met and the experience there. And once you get into an atmosphere like that, and I don't want to say it just works itself out, but you'll be in such a rich and dynamic environment wherever you go to graduate school for international affairs or international development that the rest will kind of unfold. So don't necessarily look at picking a graduate school as like, what's the place that's going to get me hot? you have to look at it as like, you know, where do I get hired after this, but also the experience itself. I mean, if you go to a Stellenbosch or if you go over to a school over in the UK, it's a tremendous experience to have. And you'll get a job. You'll be fine, you know. So don't just consider where you're going to land when you go through the process, but consider the experience that you're going to have while you're there. Because my SAIS experience was one of the best experiences of my life. It was great.
Back there. Hi, I'm Allison Calvanico with Public International Law and Policy Group. My question is, you said that you started out your career in development pretty by chance, and you hadn't really expected to go into the field, but in retrospect now, knowing that this is where you ended up, if you could go back and talk to yourself coming out of college, or to someone like me who's just starting out in a career hoping to get into development, where would you tell them to go? Or what kind of an organization or sector would you best advise to like start out in?
If I could go back and talk to myself in college, among the many things I'd say to myself would be, the language, as I said earlier, the language skills. And I mean, I would, see, it's a difficult question because I'm not really a development. I mean, I'm doing careers in international development, so I am. But, you know, my background is basically foreign policy and international relations. So I wouldn't go back and say get field experience. But I kind of would. And whether it's development or foreign policy or international business, I think I would say, all right, I'm going to finish this degree, and then I'm going to go spend 2 or 3 years overseas. And you know, for me, it would have been like Latin America, maybe, or Europe or so. But I think that that's a really, back when I was coming out, it was an important thing. And I think it's even more important now. I just think it's vital to have that overseas experience. And I don't have many or any regrets, really, in terms of career, but one or two. But the one minor regret I do have, and I mean, I'm still relatively young, so it's not unfixable, but I would go overseas, and I would do it earlier in my career. I would spend a couple of years, because I think that that combined with a graduate degree is a really dynamic combination. And look, we're talking about, we live in a country, and I'm saying this as an American, not a representative of the Australian Aid Program, but as an American, we live in a country where 60%+ of people don't have passports and don't get that experience of going beyond these borders. So I think it's just value added. That's what I would go back and say to myself. Don't hesitate, go overseas and go for a long time and then come back. Do something fun.
And I guess I just have to chime in here a little bit. I spent about 10 years overseas, 10, 12, in my career. And it really is important to get some overseas experience early on if you can. Now, I'm retired from the government. I work for an NGO. And it's really expensive to move somebody overseas and it finds out when they get there they don't like doing that stuff. And you got to move them back. So they want to see that you know what you're getting into. So it really helps. It's not impossible without it, but it really helps to have overseas experience. So they say, yeah, this person has been there, knows what he or she is getting into, and wants to do that.
Yeah, it shows a level of resiliency. It shows a level of engagement and commitment. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I hesitate about me being a development practitioner that, you know, I don't have that field experience. I have other experience, you know. For some people, my field has been D.C., you know, or the capitals or whatever, the Londons and Genevas and all that. So that's the environment that I operate in. But in terms of a development career, your street cred is so enhanced by being out there in the field. And so, I advocate everything the ambassador just said as well.
There's a pause. Well, then I've got one question I want to.
We've got one.
Oops. Okay. Oh, they're here. All right. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Allie. I'm interning at USAID and I go to the University of Maryland. And my question is, during your career, how did you gain the skills to handle relationships with foreign media? And also, how did you end up getting into photojournalism?
I got into photojournalism I've always been interested in photography. And so sometime in the late 80s or so, I bought a camera, a Nikon N2020, and spent about 6 months in Europe. And it was just, I just did it on a, it was just my passion and my interest. So I just bought a camera and told my family, told my mom that I was going to Europe for 6 months. It's funny, I remember my grandmother saying, she's like, you don't know anybody over there. What are you going to do when you get there? And I said, we're just going to get a hotel room and start taking photographs or something. So it was just kind of funny. But yeah, so it was just, I wanted to do it, so I did it. I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question? I didn't really have a formula. I just started talking to, I remember taking two journalists from Argentina up to Capitol Hill because they were interested in talking to people on the Senate Rules Committee about how the process worked. And so I just, you know, that was with the Washington Foreign Press Center and the former U.S. agency for, or U.S. Information Agency, USIA. It was probably more complicated than this at the time, but I just really got thrown into the job and I started paddling and learning how to do it. And this is why communication skills are really important, because I was able to listen to what they were interested in and what they wanted to do and then share my experiences back and forth. And so it goes back to what I said earlier about it's empathy. I mean, I think I have some level of empathy. Communication skills and listening and learning, and that's how I was able to build those bridges and relationships with the foreign media.
Hi, thank you again for today. My name's Catherine Walker, and I'm with the Office of Legislative Affairs at USAID. And one thing I'm suffering from right now is chronic interest in everything. So I'm really interested in Congress. I'm interested in the executive branch, development. I might want to run for public office one day. I don't really know. So what advice would you give someone suffering from that?
You and I suffer from the same disease. This is like, you know, my career on paper looks like it's some sort of strategically planned kind of thing, and I was like, I'm going to jump from here, and then I'm going to, and it sort of was, but the majority of it was that. It's like, I said I wanted to work in politics, policy, and international affairs when I came down here, and that was broad enough, but that was the flip side of, like, I'm interested in everything. So my brain is like 11-year-old soccer. It's like a ball goes in that direction and all the neurons go in that direction too. And I'm still like that. I mean, you know, I'm interested in all these different areas of development. I'm interested in technology. I'm interested in, you know, 100 different things. Don't try to fight it. I mean, there's a way of doing it where you can satisfy all those interests. And you're smart enough to see the linkages between them. And especially, and this is an era where the walls, the silos between a lot of issues are coming down. So you can be interested in politics and development and campaigns and foreign policy. Because if you're smart enough, and you are, you can figure out how to jump those walls. And there is no, it's a chronic condition. There is no, you know, there is no known cure for it. So enjoy that. It's like that, enjoy that intellectual ferment. And, just, you know, there's a way of doing it, and it's intuitive, and you'll figure it out. But don't sort of put yourself into some mental prison and say, I need to only focus on this, because this for my money, it's not true. You can have all those interests, and you can pursue all those interests. And I mean, I've done it, and it's even more doable now. So keep being interested like that, and just add some strategery to it, career-wise, and it'll work out fine.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Araceli Ornelas. I'm a PhD student, and I would like to know, how do you see yourself in 10 years? Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I was about to say, I haven't heard this question since my last interview. This is a good question, though. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where I'll be in 10 years. If you had told me, I've been at the Australian Embassy for 6 years. If you told me 6 years ago I'd be at the Australian Embassy doing international development for the Australian Aid Program, I would have said, what are you talking about? 10 years ago, I kind of hit a career rut, you know, and before the Department of Energy, I was at sort of this career inflection point. And so what I'd like to be doing is still working on development-related issues, but I also suffer from this chronic illness that is like everything is interesting. So, I mean, I've thought about actually going overseas for a while, maybe, getting into local issues, because I'm interested in the fact that there are a lot of things that we handle and deal with in the development space that are applicable to developed countries. And I'm interested in that sort of transfer between how do you take what the dynamism that's going on in parts of the global south and bring it to the global north, or whatever we call this, the west. How do you take some of that dynamism and energy and inject it back into the west, and some of the ideas that work in the Congo that could possibly work in South Central or in Appalachia, you know? So, I mean, I'd like to give you a clearer answer where I'll be in 10 years, but that's part of the adventure. But what I do want to be doing is still working on exciting and interesting issues with exciting and interesting people, and that's what I've been doing for the past 6 years with Australia, and I'm pretty sure I'll be doing that somewhere when I'm 62 years old in 10 years. Boy, that's interesting. Frightening. Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm mindful of the time, and what I'm going to ask the final question, and then Clarence will be around for a little bit,
sure,
in case you still want to ask further questions. And building on your last question, I know you're leaving.
Yeah.
And moving to the West Coast, and you're going to try and mesh somehow development issues, economic growth, and technology. How did you sort of zero in on that and make your decision?
It's I got zeroed in on it because the Australian Aid Program and DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, we have an agency called the Innovation Exchange. And it's really focused on how do you source new ideas and new technologies and new thinking for longstanding challenges. The Innovation Exchange has done some interesting work on aquaculture in the Pacific. We've done a lot of work with entrepreneurs who are using UAVs, for example, to deliver medical supplies. And just looking at their work and helping them to raise awareness of what the Innovation Exchange is doing in, you know, in the Indo-Pacific region, and working with entrepreneurs and impact investors, got me thinking more and got me interested in just these emerging technologies, the fourth industrial revolution technologies like UAVs, 3D printing. I did a course up at Harvard called Innovation for Economic Development with the late Professor Calestous Juma, which added to my interest in it. It's fascinating. So I'm looking at all these technologies and how the world is changing, and I'm wondering, you know, how does that mesh with economic growth in countries in the Indo-Pacific and really globally? And so that's how that interest has developed. And I'm looking forward to moving west in a few weeks and testing out the theory that I can jump into it. And once again, you know, since my attention span is a mile wide and an inch deep, and I'm interested in a lot of different things, I'm interested in taking what I've learned working with Australia and working here in Washington and applying it in a new arena, in a new, in a what I feel like is a more dynamic arena out on the West Coast. So, yeah, that's so that the interest just came from working with the people that I work with at the AID program and just researching and reading more about where the world is going and technology, and I want to see how that impacts people going forward as we enter this new era.
Well, we wish you great success.
Thank you very much.
And please join me in thanking Clarence Edwards for being here today.